the paper.
Welcome to episode 123 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand paper making and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand paper making studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. You can also find the show notes for this episode at HelenHebertStudio.com/podcast. Today, I'm talking with Beth Kephart, a National Book Award finalist and the award-winning author of some 40 books in multiple genres, an award-winning teacher of memoir, a widely published essayist, and a woman who loves paper. Her new book is My Life in Paper, Adventures in Ephemera, which was recently published by Temple University Press. Enjoy our conversation. Beth Kephart, welcome to Paper Talk.
This is a dream to be on this with you, Helen.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm really looking forward to talking about your new book, but let's just start a little bit with a little bit about you and how you got into writing and what led up to this book. So, tell me just a little bit about your childhood growing up and creativity and writing. I think you knew you wanted to be a writer early on.
I knew I wanted to write. I didn't know what being a writer meant or what a writer is. I still am learning that 40-some books into my career. I grew up moving around with my father, had different jobs. And when I was 9, we lived for a year in Boston, and I began to skate on a frozen pond there. I associate my love for writing with my skating. I skated on that pond, but then when we returned to Wilmington, Delaware, I took lessons. And the thing that I was sort of known for was the this sort of interpretive skating where they would play music and you'd hear it a couple of times and go out and create on the spot your own choreography. I feel that writing for me is like that too. Writing is movement and it's dance, and it is ultimately, when you're working on structure, choreography. So those two things. I was a very bad writer. I was a sentimental writer. I wrote sonnets about Zeus that, you know, embarrass me and shame me to this day. But I had a teacher named Dr. Dewsnap, and she saw something in me. And she encouraged the work. And then I went to the University of Pennsylvania, where I studied the history and sociology of science, not writing, but wrote privately for a long time until I decided I would try not to be so private.
Okay. And you mentioned that you've written 40 plus books. So what was the first publishing venture?
Initially, I was publishing short stories, about 3 dozen short stories in literary magazines. And then I began to write a series of memoirs. They were very personal stories about what I've been taught, really, by those I love, about overcoming challenges, about friendship. The third book is called Still Life, Still Love in Strange Places. My husband's Salvadoran, and that book took 15 years. It started as a novel, became a memoir about El Salvador, the country, the politics, the volcanoes, and his particular story, his grandfather and the farms and his mother. And so what I've always loved to do is to research deeply and to wrap a story through and around what I learned. There's no point to me in writing, even though for me, even though I write memoir, teach memoir, I'm really not interested only in what I know about myself. I am always in pursuit of something. And I feel like writing has been my privileged window into a reason to keep learning and buying old books and interviewing people.
Yeah, I love that. I feel the same way as an artist. It's a journey, and things unfold. Yeah. So do you have training in writing, or
what is that? I As I said, my degree was in the history and sociology of science, and I had never even met a writer until my son was a few years old, and I heard a writer, her name was Fahmy Enig, on NPR, and she happened to be in Philadelphia. I was driving the car, and I turned it around, and my husband met me at the bookstore, and I met her, stood in that line, and it was my first, I was, you know, like 30s, early 30s, first time I met a writer. I then went as three separate family vacations. My husband and son were with me to Spoleto, Italy, where Rose Ellen Brown, and who's still a friend, and Reginald Gibbs were teaching. I went to Prague, where I became friends with Jane Ann Phillips. And then Jane Ann invited me to Breadloaf. And again, each time my family came. Up until that point, I had been purely an autodidact, reading as much as I could and experimenting and learning a lot from rejection letters from editors or editors who asked me to try again. My first published piece was in a small, well, it was an 8.5 by 11 stapled book, a literary book called Iowa Woman. And it was three rounds, you know, through the mail with their notes on my typed pages. And it was the first time in my life that anyone had said, here's something else you can do with a sentence. Here's a tangent that doesn't fit. And I've learned a lot that way.
Right. I feel like, you know, I mostly self-taught artist. And sometimes I feel like that naivete or whatever it is valuable. Do you feel that way at all? Like you
I
just,
do.
Yeah.
But boy, are you damn good for being self-taught. I think, and we probably share this too, that teaching others is teaching ourselves. And so after my first book, when I was asked to start teaching, you know, just single day workshops, that sort of thing in the beginning, I was so taken aback by that. And then it forced me to articulate to myself what I was trying to do on the page. And then when the University of Pennsylvania asked me to teach, you know, a semester a year, I spent 4 months at least building the syllabus, testing every angle, you know, what we were going to read inside, outside. What kind of conversation might this prompt? Like imagining the whole thing. And now teaching as I do, as much as I do, I'm still committed to throwing myself into a place of not knowing. And then like this morning, my husband and I are going to be doing a month long thing. Once a week over the course of a month, something that's really new for me. And I deliberately had us announce it before I knew for sure if I could do it. And that's sort of where I like to be.
Yeah.
Because now I have to do it.
Right.
So yeah, I'm going to be scared and I'm going to learn a lot.
Yeah, totally, totally relate to that. I remember.
Triaxial weaving.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. Beth took my Weave Through Winter, which just finished. And yeah, I've done that for 6 years, and the first 4 years, other people in the course would be weaving triaxials. And I'm like, And I would try in between and fail. And then finally, the last 2 years, I got it. And now I'm writing instructions.
Yes. I don't even know how you can write instructions for
that. So you have an interest in book arts, too. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, after I graduated from Penn, I worked at an architecture firm because I had been inspired by who we called him Uncle Lloyd. His wife was my father's aunt, but they were never quite married, but they lived together for many, many years. And she was essentially his business manager in some ways. And he designed the Waldorf Astoria and the Pierre and had in his home this massive mural that placed every building he ever designed in oil paints all together in the same cityscape. And for some reason, I knew from the time, you know, very early on when I was there, that even though I myself was word oriented, what I wanted to be around was artists and architects. And so my first job out of Penn was to work in an architecture firm, being their marketing person, writing all of the proposals and organizing their library and meeting people. And I met within a few weeks the very handsome Salvadoran guy named William Sulett, who then quickly left to go to Yale to get his master's degree in architecture. But we got married a couple of weeks after he returned 2 years later, meaning I hardly knew the guy, but he was very cute and very talented. So I've been around artists and architects by design for a long time. I never thought that I could or should step into that world other than to admire what my husband did and to go to the museums and look at things and read about artists. But when my father died in August of 2020, it was a very hard thing for me. And at the time, I didn't believe I would write again. I felt as if, because my dad had been, especially after my mother died, my mother was sort of jealous of my writing. But once she died, once she passed away, my father felt he could be part of my writing life. So if I was researching something, I would kind of give him projects, you know, for like a novel I wrote called The Great Upending. I gave him a project on how fire would start in a certain place in a barn, and what, because he was an engineer. Mm-hmm. And he would come to my launches, and it didn't feel like it was worth it anymore to write if my dad wasn't going to be there to experience it with me. Plus he died during COVID, and he was all, and I used to spend every day with him and I couldn't see him for months. So after he died, the thing he wanted the most, Helen, was a funeral. I would go to funerals for him when he got too frail to go, and I would come back, this was before COVID, and talk to him, and he would say how many people were at the funeral. And I knew he would do this, so I would count. And so that was, my father was super modest, but for some reason, and of course we couldn't have a funeral for him. The funeral was him being buried, you know, beside my mother beneath these gorgeous Carillon bells in Valley Forge Memorial Park. And I thought, I can't have a funeral for him, but I can make sure he's remembered. So I started to, with a jelly plate, which didn't really know how to use, I started to make jelly art, and I taught myself a chain stitch, and I began to make these cards that had paper inside and sent them to about 150 people in the end, asking them to remember my father inside those. And I was obsessed with doing it. I would stand in the kitchen, which is where I did this then, for 8-10 hours a day. I had this little rolling cart, roll it out, you know, I use the kitchen table, put everything, I would do it like from 5 to 7, then it's breakfast, put everything away, breakfast is over, put it all out, all day long. And my husband, watching this, recognized how much it meant to me and how calming it was. And so I forget what he bought me first. It might have been a marbling kit, or it might have been the Arnold Brumer handmade paper kit, but he began to supplement. Like for every birthday, my birthday's in April, and every Christmas, that's what he started to do. In fact, 2 days ago, he said to me, I've run out of things. Because then he bought me a sewing machine this last Christmas. I'm like, stop, I cannot learn anything else. And so now he said, I've been looking for a really cool mold and decal that you could just hang on the wall. You know, so my husband has always, but what's really amazing about Bill, being the extraordinary artist that he is, he has never come in and said, you know, too much blue, too much paint, you're working too close to the edge, I don't like your weaving. You know, he has just watched me do it. And so your class was, I have some sort of, it's not dyslexia, but it's something that makes it very hard for me to learn, like looking at instructions, reading instructions, very hard for me. So your paper weaving was the first thing in the art that I'd actually taken. Bill and I had done clay together, but he did all of the, you know, the forming of it. And I'm good with color, so I would glaze, but I couldn't figure, I can't throw a pot in my life. So your class was the first I felt I can, even if I'm still on day 30, just doing straight strips, I can do that, you know?
Yeah. Oh. Okay. So now tell me what Bill does now. And I know that you guys run juncture workshops. Tell me a little bit about that. And
Bill is out there in a shed, a very beat up shed, working on oil painting. He is a trained architect, as I said, but he stopped doing architecture after a while. And then he started to work with graphic design. I had to kind of support the family. Mm. Always worked in corporate America, but as a freelancer, because I raised my son, you know, I didn't have a nanny or anything. And, you know, it was important for me to be home with Jeremy. So I was working in a lot of, I would work through the night for companies like Ron Blank, writing all kinds of stuff about their new products, their new people, whatever it is. I began to have a pretty large clientele. And when Bill left architecture, I would market then myself as the research writer, working with corporate executives on vision statements, employee communications, annual reports, and Bill doing the designing of the books. And then as I began to make books and as I began to teach, our presentations are really intense and they are illustrated. So they're typographically beautiful, but if I'm teaching something about character development, say, Bill does drawings for them. And mm-hmm. now he's doing these remarkable oil paintings, and we have a book of my essays coming out where he's working on the art for that. So he's through Bind Arts, which is the thing we created. We sell his gorgeous sculptural and other types of pottery and my paperwork. And we sometimes combine in his graphic work some of my marbling and some of, we try to bring the two arts together. That's why it's called Bind Arts.
And you sell those items on Etsy, anywhere else? Or
we sell them on Etsy. And then last year we joined, so on Etsy are my handmade books that I began. You should have seen me trying to teach myself the Coptic stitch, Helen. that was something, but I do it now.
Yeah.
But once I figured that out, after many sad moments of what? What I didn't know, because I'm so uneducated, is that you needed a curved needle. And I kept trying.
Oh,
This is impossible. What are they doing? Oh, it's because I would take books, look at them, and try to figure it out.
Right.
That's the only way I knew how to learn. So I thought of my blank books, which are covered with my cyanotypes or marbled papers, or now with some of the weaving. But I would always put a prompt from some old book like Lauren Isley or Virginia Woolf. So I think of my blank books that I sell at Etsy and the farmers markets as me kind of sending memoir or story back down, but here's the blank book, here's a prompt, write to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I sell the blank books, bookmarks that I make with the various art. Bill and I are my paper art and his paper art together, and then his clay.
Okay. Wow. And I know one of your books is a like a memoir workbook. I want to talk about that. And I want you also, you wrote me a wonderful little description of what a memoir is to you. Talk a little about that.
My career, one of the reasons I will never be famous, which is really, really, really okay by me, is that I have explored a lot of different, you know, arts in literary and otherwise. So many of my books have been published traditionally, whether they're HarperCollins or Simon Schuster, Random House, Norton, Houghton Mifflin, I don't think I said. But when Bill and I created Juncture Workshops, which is where I teach memoir, first we were doing it in person, we now do it over Zoom. We also wanted to create a series of resources for memoir writers. So Tell the Truth, Make It Matter was the first workbook that we published ourselves. Bill designed it. It's not like I sent it out into the world and everybody said no. So we deliberately said, Juncture is going to create a series of resources. There's the newsletter, there's the workshops, there are these books that Bill beautifully designs and we put out in the world. So there's five or six of them now. Tell the Truth, Make It Matter is a traditional workbook with lines in it. And it takes the writer from some very early warm-up exercises in voice and truth-telling, etc., all the way through to the preface for their memoir. And not every memoir needs or wants a preface, but I do think it's important to develop a preface. And it is in that vessel of the preface that you're going to learn voice, or you're going to practice voice, develop the voice for that book, where you're going to identify for yourself what the primary themes of the book are, et cetera. So that's what that does. And what is a memoir, you asked? And in My Life and Paper, I talk about it as a certain kind of obsession vessel. But in my notes to you today, I was saying that it is very simply not autobiography and not fiction and almost anything in between. It is taking so many forms, whether they're speculative memoir or hybrid memoir or memoir in pieces, which is what my previous book, Wife, Daughter, Self, was. But it is really not just, I want to tell you the story of my life. We could say that Dard Hunter's book was autobiography. I loved it anyway. But there are a lot of great autobiographies. What would have made Dard's book a memoir is if he had become, in the pages, more self-reflective rather than repertorial about how he was living, what he was seeing, what he was doing. And many of those who wish to write memoir need to be eased into. And that is often my job in working with people, easing them into, well, how do we make this bigger than you? Because it's only going to be interesting unless you're a celebrity and something scandalous has happened. It's only going to be interesting to the other if that person can slip themselves inside your world and say, huh, something like that happened to me.
Yeah. I just want to read what you wrote me because I think it's so succinct. So you said part of it already. A memoir is not an autobiography and it is not fiction. It is a search for universal truth, which you just described, for greater understanding about the human condition through the lens of a particular story. I love that.
You know, what's cool about that too is you can then write more than one.
Exactly.
If you are writing an autobiography, now Dard wrote two, you know, an early one and then second. Then the autobiography becomes sort of, you know, successive. Then in my 40s, this happened. Whereas a memoir, you can, right now I'm thinking about what friendship is. So I'm looking at that through the lens. Right now, for example, in My Life in Paper, I'm thinking about how paper holds or doesn't hold who we are and who those we loved were. That's my lens. I'm not allowed to write outside that lens. So it gives you, it's hard, but it's comforting because it gives you boundaries. Oh, doesn't fit.
Right. Yeah. I love that. Okay. So let's talk about your book and let's see the full title, My Life in Paper, Adventures in Ephemera. So first you mentioned Dard Hunter and so let's talk about how the book came about, but also for those who don't know who Dard Hunter is, let's introduce him.
Dard Hunter, when I talk about him, I say he was the great paper adventurer who traveled more than a million miles in search of an understanding of how paper is made in various parts of the world. Born in 1866, I think, no, 1883, and died in 1966. He collected pieces of paper from everywhere he went. He twice tried to create his own paper mills. He was quasi-successful, but saw himself as a failure with those, essentially. But then he would come back from his travels, and not in all cases, but in many, would then he chiseled out the type font, he wrote the words, he used his handmade paper, everything. And he set these books. He had them bound elsewhere. And then they would sell out. You know, it would be 179 copies, say. And then when he had enough money, off he'd go, leaving Edith and the boys at home for another adventure. And how I came to know that is by fluke. My brother, who I love very much, had us, my family, for Thanksgiving, actually, but we do Thanksgiving, Christmas together. And Jeff, in typical Jeff style, was running around the house because I am a gift maker, a gift giver. I'm like, I'm always, all through the year, I'm buying gifts. And Jeff's like, oh no, Beth's coming. I got to give her something, right? So he goes around. And weirdly, I had helped my father for 10 months. Deconstruct the house he and my mother lived in so we could move him to another place. But I never, my mother hid things from me, and I had never known about this Dart Hunter book. And Jeff said, here's this book. It's about paper. Look inside. I have a copy over there, the copy over here. It's got some handmade paper sewn into it. Thought you might like it. So I started reading this, and I don't know what it was, but Dard's voice was just there in the room with me. And I saw a man in him who was sometimes humble bragging, sometimes deeply didn't know how talented he was, sometimes overstating, sometimes empathetic, but there was something about his unsuredness tucked into parts of these stories. Despite the fact that there he is with Gandhi talking, and there he is, that just, I felt it deeply. And I think I felt it deeply because I was struggling at the University of Pennsylvania to teach during COVID with two masks, everybody wearing two masks. And I felt, because my style is very much about building community, I felt like I couldn't reach the people I needed to reach. And Dard also, at parts of his life when he was trying to build a museum at MIT, and then, you know, and the sort of getting the wrong questions or not sure what his legacy would be, I was like, I get you. And so just because he was my companion, my psychological companion, I started writing letters to him, not expecting to write a book.
Okay, so then how did the book come about? Because they include these letters, or maybe you wrote more, I don't know, or maybe it changed. And then it's just a really interesting format, story of your life, these letters to Dard, and then little factual information about ephemera. Yeah.
I am at heart, of course, this memoirist. And when Dard began to populate or be in my head, I started to think about paper and the role it does play in our lives. It's not the book that Dard would have written, because some of the paper I'm talking about is not handmade paper, but it's maps, you know, the maps that we would unfold when we were kids. It's sheet music. It's my mother's paper doilies beneath her delicious cakes. It's her sewing patterns. It began to occur to me that here I am, a memoirist, helping people and sometimes helping myself, you know, put ourselves for some kind of time, not all time, but down on paper in some kind of, this is me, I won't disappear fashion, you know. And so to do that, you're dealing with memory, and memory is fallible. And so I started to think, what holds the truth? Paper, which can blow away, be set on fire, be set down a river, or memory, which begins to curdle and shift with each retelling. And these two things became the, you know, the big gestalt kind of idea in my head. And so the book is organized into these sections. Each section begins with a letter I write to Dard, but maybe that letter is about obsession or possession or home or erasure. And then I choose these elements of paper ephemera, write very personally about them. And then to open this up, to make it that universal thing, I footnote those pieces in a way that I hope will open up for readers. And the weird thing is, paper doily seems to do that for a lot of people. When they get to paper doily, I get these notes of people who are saying, I am sitting here sobbing. Because you've just returned to me my mother's baking, you know, and that is what I wanted to do. when I launched the book at the Free Library of Philadelphia, I read the sewing patterns piece, among other things. And the people who came up to talk to me afterwards were all about, you just brought back to me something I didn't remember. My mother with pins in her mouth trying to make me a dress for Halloween or something. And that's what makes it universal.
Hey listeners, let's take a little break here, and I want to make sure you know about my how-to books about papermaking and papercrafts. My latest book is called The Art of Papercraft, and it offers a rich variety of projects that will delight crafters, artists, and designers alike, including paper votives, pop-up cards, folded paper gift boxes and envelopes, woven paper wall hangings, miniature one-sheet books, and much more. I also have two popular books about papermaking, Papermaking with Garden Plants and Common Weeds, and The Papermaker's Companion. All three books are available on Kindle. Now back to our conversation.
Well, tell me about this student and like how you did the research for your book.
The research took place in a number of different ways. But fortunately, the University of Pennsylvania has this tremendous rare book library called Kislak, which has a number of these original Dart Hunter books. How exciting it was to go up there. And they hadn't taken those books out of down below the vaults for a long time. So when they emailed and said, we're ready for you. And I went in, there were Dart Hunter's books, and everybody in the rare book room, which I thought was supposed to be a quiet place, but it wasn't, was so excited. And my first feeling was my mother should be here, you know, because without her, without my brother, I wouldn't know this man existed. But I began to go early. I would teach on Tuesdays at Penn, and I would go early and stay late and hang out with Dard and with other book artists. They have an amazing collection of book artists there, Helen. Have you been there to Kislak?
I haven't, no.
Oh my gosh. I would come and they're like, you got to see this book artist. Where, you know, I just had so much fun. But right towards the end of the semester, a young woman who I absolutely adore, and that's the thing, I do adore my students, was sitting outside on a bench as I was about to go into Kislak. And I said, what are you doing, Beatrice? And she said, I'm trying to gather the energy to do my last project, you know, for Penn. And I said, come with me. And so we went up into the Kislak. Mm-hmm. And she had such an appreciation for my appreciation. I mean, it was just such a beautiful thing. And I, you know, we would write to each other. But I still had left that semester, although the last several weeks of the semester, everybody came together and it was probably the best semester I ever taught. I still had this lingering fear that I hadn't been my best. And B wrote me this beautiful letter that, with her permission, is now in the book under correspondence. And B just sent me a photo. She traveled around the world for a while after Penn. She just sent me a photograph of her apartment now in New York City and the fireplace. And it has a picture. She has the copy of the book there on the mantle. And she just sent a picture and she'd written something in, she'd painted, I wish I had it right here, but I don't. She'd painted these words to me. I mean, words wherever, you know, since you're essentially, you're not here, but you are here with me.
Mm-hmm.
Those were not the exact words. And, you know, she's someone, like so many of my students, who keeps me tethered to what is human at a time when I'm so terrified about the world. And my students do that for me. Paper, working with my hands, does, and still writing does that for me.
Right. So she somehow sparked something
no.
with the book. No,
no, that she, wasn't no, even. She was just there while I was.
It was just a wonderful her seeing you shine in this library. Yeah.
Okay. Well, she saw my curiosity and my obsession.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't shining. I was just like, look at this.
Yeah.
And she was like, I see it. You know.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. And I know you visited the Robert C. Williams American
yes.
Museum of Papermaking. And
but
you
first,
wanted to
I went
share
to the Mountain House.
Oh, he went to Mountain House first. Okay.
And spent a few an evening, an afternoon, evening, and morning with Dard Hunter III, who allowed us into well, he it's an invitation open to many to go into Mountain House, and then we also went to Dard's amazing framing craft workshop. I'm sure you've been there several times and know him well, but going into Mountain House
Okay,
was.
describe what Mountain House is.
Oh, I'm
So
sorry. Mountain
that's
House
okay.
is in Chillicothe, and it is where the first Dard Hunter lived and died. He died in the living room there. And Dard Hunter III was Dard was Dard's son, Dard Hunter II's son. He was born shortly after the first Dard Hunter died, so he never met or was held by his grandfather, but he now lives in his grandfather's house, which he is renovating in a beautiful way, so that the kid, because he is a woodworker, Dard Hunter the Third, and making this incredible kitchen and all kinds of things for him and his wife. But he was an important player in this. I would not have written the book without his permission. So the first thing I did was, after I'd written about 50 to 100 pages, is I wrote to him and I said, he didn't know me from Adam. I'm doing this. Is that okay? It took a while. Dard Hunter III is a gorgeous texter when he texts. He doesn't always. And he said, he said some really beautiful things and gave me permission to write the book. And he read the book throughout. He never made a change. He's this quiet person who would say, "I'm glad to see you're so interested." That would be it. But he showed me where Catherine Baker, who's the Dard Hunter biographer, who sat in that house for a long time and really gave us the true, line by line history of Dard Hunter. He showed me how and where she did her research. The vault is there where original Dard Hunter things, the press that Dard Hunter worked on. So that was really important. And that was Chillicothe, Ohio. And then Bill and I drove to Atlanta to go to Georgia Tech, where the Morris Museum is. It has about 100,000 artifacts that Dard collected over time. It's the third museum of Dard Hunter's work. He went from MIT to Wisconsin, and now it's permanently housed there. And while there, I met I mean, we had been in correspondence of Virginia Howe, who told a story which I had said that I would read.
Yeah,
Um,
this is a
so
great
this is a
story.
paragraph from the book, and this is from the letter to Dard called Possession. So I am talking to Dard as I write this, but something unexpected happened when I talked to Virginia Howe about Dard. And then there were the stories Virginia began to tell about her own family roots in Chillicothe, about your mountain house, and about your son, Dard II, who designed the wedding bands that her grandparents wore, and whose very life was saved by Virginia's own great-grandmother, who whisked him away to the hospital when he was a kid with a burst appendix and a Christian Scientist for a mother, a kid who would have died without such great-grandmotherly quick thinking and practical disregard for Edith's famous Christian Scientist stance, which she applied to the health of her own children. Wait, I heard myself interrupting Virginia. Wait, your great grandmother saved Dard Second's life? She nodded, Dard, as if this were the simplest fact in the world, the most minor of coincidences. And when I told, I, and I said to Virginia, but does Dard Hunter the Third know this? She goes, no, how can he know? So he was very intrigued. I said, you wouldn't exist without Virginia Howe's great grandmother. He's like, wow.
Yeah, that is so funny. Virginia Howell is the director of the Paper Museum in Atlanta now
Yeah.
that houses Dard Hunter's entire collection.
I
Wow.
love the way you keep
Almost.
cleaning up after the fact that I just go in enthusiastically. You're like, well, let me pin that to the page. There's Helen, like, giving instructions on
Just a little bit of
just making
background.
sure it's even understandable.
Okay, so you mentioned ice skating and sewing, and you have another little bit you wanted to share.
I know, and I think that in my enthusiasm just then, I probably got rid of that marked page. I will just say, here it is, sewing pattern, that researching the sewing pattern was super interesting to me. I learned so much. And it turns out that the original sewing patterns, like the reproducible, get them in a package, the lady down the street can make the same thing you're making, originated with a woman who called herself Madame Demarest. Her name was actually Ellen Louise Curtis. And she had the idea for making packaged patterns. Well, after being recently married, taking some time off, she was a hat maker, and watching her maid pin paper to something and cutting it out. And she soon decided that she would assemble the segments for demonstration purposes. So she then, living in Philadelphia, and a lot of this book is Philadelphia-centric, she has a day when she announces that she's got these first of their kind sewing patterns. And the person who tells us this story is a writer, this is an old book, but named Ishmael Ross. And this is what Ross says about that day when these patterns were unveiled. Women in tartans with wasp waists, wide sleeves, and flying bow knots clustered around the narrow house, this is late 19th century, and blocked the stairs and sidewalk. They were face to face with a provocative innovation at a time when the sewing machine was whirring its way to mass popularity. And so these patterns took off. They were exhibited in the 1876 centennial. I love the Demarest because they were progressives. They had really interesting and important people working in their stores. And they did not patent their design.
Right.
Butterick did. And so they didn't really benefit as much financially, but they do in my book.
Yeah.
They're the heroes of my book in sewing patterns.
Yeah. Yeah. It's wonderful. All of these little stories about all of this ephemera. I think you rattled off a few other things, but what other ephemera?
Well, let me
can
go
you
through
talk about.
Yeah. Baby books, but I start with baby books, scrapbooks, photographs, menus, homework, diaries, paper bags, amateur art, oatmeal boxes, recipes, sheet music deeds. I'm skipping some, of course, blueprints, rare books.
And at sewing patterns.
Yeah.
So I wanted to. Yeah. So the sewing patterns, you go on to tell the story about your mother sewing a skating costume, outfit, not sure what the right word is, and that you would have preferred to have one off the rack. And I just totally remember things like that from my childhood with my mother sewing clothing for me and baking homemade bread that I had to take to school and be humiliated because my bread wasn't the white Wonder Bread, and
but Helen, didn't you, during this month of weaving, wasn't one of your inspirations something from that your mother, wasn't some clothing from when you were young? I remember one of your weaving inspirations, that you were going back in time and honoring that. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
It's not popping into mind, but yes, I mean, I do have, certainly. Yeah. Yeah.
Because so, now we honor it.
Uh-huh. That's right. It's different stages of life. But now, did we cover the three? So the book, you have these lovely stories about the history of different things, your own and your own memoir stories, and then your letters to Dard. Yeah.
Yep. We didn't do daily practice or papers.
That's okay. That's right. Yeah, yeah. So, having come off of this, my Weave Through Winter class is a daily practice, and you're a prolific writer. I wanted to just talk a little bit about your sort of how your days go.
And they never do go according to any plan. The only constants are that unless it's really horrific weather, I will always take an hour long walk, and I will always make a really nice, nutritious dinner. Mm-hmm. I don't write every day. But when I can go months without writing, real writing. But when I am writing, it's from 4 to 6 in the morning when there is only silence. That is the only time in my day that I'm sure will not be interrupted. When we were doing the weaving in February, I had a couple of essays I had to write. So I'd work in the morning. And then I would work really from like 7 to 10 or 11 on the weaving. So when that isn't the case, the ideal day would be writing from 4 to 6, having an hour with my husband over breakfast, working paper in the early morning, and then the rest of the time is teaching. And teaching is, a lot of it is designing these presentations. I'm working on one right now. I just did one on the art of the obsession, but I'm doing right now on telling detail. And I'm going to be looking at 3 authors who I think are exceptionally good at this. And it means really just spending a lot of time with those particular books. Often I'm referencing 2 dozen books. This time I'm doing 3.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm deeply, deeply involved in those presentations. Each presentation takes about 3 weeks to craft.
I'm sure. Yeah.
So that's a lot of my time. And then my students from Penn zoom in, or my adult students that I work with. I'm working with a man who is writing a really important book. He's a very cool guy, and I'm loving working with him. One of my students today texted me at 5 in the morning. I was up, and her book that we worked on together launches today. So her daughter threw her a big surprise party.
Oh.
So there's a lot of interaction with my students.
Love that. So the workshops that you're crafting for 3 weeks, are those through Juncture workshops?
Most of the time,
yeah.
Although in April, I'm giving a new one for Craft Talks, which is this international
okay.
program. And then I'm doing one in the telling detail is Cleaver, Obsession was Cleaver. These are kind of established memoir resource places.
Okay.
But in, and they asked me to guest teach in October. My husband and I are doing I think it's every Saturday or Sunday, something that's multimedia and multi-genre. And I'm, for example, studying John Singer Sargent and looking at how he developed portraits, so that all of how that applies to writing, whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction or poetry. I'm looking at Van Gogh landscapes. And then my husband's art will be as prompt material brought in. So it's like, it's in depth. I want to do John Singer Sargent as he painted Isabella Stewart Gardner. And so it's their whole story.
Wow.
That somebody will get in very economical. I bet you don't believe I can do it economically given how much I'm talking, but in very economical segments.
Yeah. Cool. Cool. I know in the book you wrote about this time in your life when you were getting art supplies and anticipating their arrival. And maybe you can talk a little bit about that time in your life, and tell me some of your favorite papers since we're on paper talk.
I am still that person who I am really upset or, you know, anxious. I have a lot of anxiety. It's buying paper that calms me down, really looking at Hiromi or Talus, or sometimes Blick has or Mulberry papers or whatever it is. I really, just looking at the paper, I can feel my heart go down. And then if I've had a good month, you know, if there's any extra left over from the dinners and the mortgage and whatever, if I have $100, say, I will maybe every 2 or 3 months buy paper, even if I don't need it, because I just can't wait to open the box. So one of the illustrators I work with, I do picture books, and I'm working on a new picture book about paper for kids.
Yeah.
And you're in it. And the illustrator for that book, as a gift, because I sort of established a tie with her and that publishing house, she sent me a gift certificate to Hiromi, and I was like floored. It was so, the thing that I bought that I would never buy myself was one of those tomato papyrus. And I tried, Helen, to follow your instruction. How the heck do people make these papyrus, because I have your, you know, one of your, I have a couple of your books, and I got the material and all, and it was horrible. And so I'm looking at it right now. It's this great piece of tomato papyrus. I won't use it for anything. I love the crispiness of batik, especially when we were weaving. I loved that. But I also love the really kind of soft Thai mango paper. That was my favorite weave, was when I was really using mostly all of that. The Nepal quilt dots from the latke plant. And then I do marble my own paper, and I really like that paper. I like making it. And I make my own handmade paper, and I recently made mushroom paper, which turned out really nice. I don't ever want to use chemicals, so I use okra juice. And the mushroom paper is really smooth, and I use it for the books I'm, you know, for covers. And I was weaving with it, and it wove well.
How
So
did you? I have not made mushroom paper. I've seen it. What did you start with and how did you process it?
I just started with, I was like, I just want to make, in the same way that I made grass paper, like, how do I do this? There, I did need to use some chemicals to break down the grass. But with the mushrooms, I didn't. I just bought, I don't know whether it was 1 pound or 2 pounds of button mushrooms, and I rinsed them well, et cetera. And then I used an immersion blender. And I had, meanwhile, I tear up my own old books that were sort of, you know, galleys or whatever. And I had that paper soaking. And I mean, ultimately, you do what you do with paper. You combine them. And then I like to use pom-pom flowers that I learned the hard way that the flowers are going to brown and crisp unless you do something with them. So I quickly steam them. Well, I quickly boil them and then ice cube them and then, you know, dry them. And so this mushroom paper was a combination of the tiny, I mean, just the tiny little yellow pom pom floating across a smooth mushroom. I did it twice, and you know, the darkness is how much mushroom you end up using.
And there are certain flowers. I know oblation papers and press, which is a handmade paper. They produce wedding invitations in Portland, Oregon, and they also have a beautiful retail store. They use fresh flower petals, so you have to know which one. So
Wow.
just so we're being accurate here, that there
Okay,
are
yeah,
some
cool.
that work and don't brown, and you don't have to dry. You can just go right from the
Oh,
plant, which is cool.
I'm gonna find out about
Carnations,
that.
carnations is one,
Really? Okay, I'm gonna
and
write
they're
that down.
listed in, I think they're listed in my book, The Papermaker's Companion. There's a list of flowers. Back to the vegetable papyrus. I'm gonna guess it was the pressing. You have to have a really strong press. Did you try tomato? I think I did
I
tomatoes, but
tried zucchini.
so yeah, zucchini is a good one, because it's not too hard, but you have to have a lot of pressure. You have to really be able to press, and then dry properly before they start molding. So
That's what happened to me. I got mold and I was doing it outside, and I got some flying animals that were interested too.
Oh, yes. So what are you working on now? I want to hear about a little bit more about this book, the paper, the children's book.
Oh, Astra Publishing, Kane Press, wonderful editor there. But I have been thinking about how interesting paper is and how many lives it has. And that, do kids know, for example, that a whole observatory tower dome was made just out of paper? Do they know that a synagogue and some housing has been made out of paper tubes and that sort of thing? So I wanted to do something that would be surprising and fun about paper. And then when Astra bought it, they also wanted craft, like four or five crafts in the back. And then before they bought it, they said, "We love this, but we do series of books. And so we really want to do a basic material series with you. What other, oh, there's a lot of history in it, you know, in this paper book. It's 48 pages. And so there will be clay, fabric and hue as well. I'm working on the clay book right now.
And they'll come out
Every
one
6 months,
after
I
the other.
think. Every 6 months, yeah.
And what's the age target? Like,
I never know the answer to that, but I would say that it's probably maybe first, second, third grade to fifth. I certainly, in doing the craft section, made it so that here is something you can do very simply. If you want to make it a little more sophisticated, you can do it. You know, if there's a teacher or a parent with you, you know, you can up it this way. You're, as I mentioned earlier, Helen's in the book as the place to go for the crafts. And so it's been really interesting. Harold is one of the most renowned, although he won't admit it, but he's so lovely and smart, nonfiction picture book editors. So it's gone through 18 to 20 drafts.
Wow, cool. Cool. And when does that come out?
That's not till 2025.
Okay. Oh, that's closer than you think. Okay, and you had a couple of recommendations.
Oh gosh, yes. Where did I put the
I
recommendations?
know, so you mentioned cyanotype, I think, and you do a lot of those. And
Yeah.
so that was your first BFK Reeves paper.
I love that paper so much. It's so soft. Do you use it?
I have used it, but not on a regular basis.
It's so soft. And if you've done cyanotypes on many different kinds of paper, as I have, I will never do it on anything other than that. It's just, it's dimensional. It's soft. I love to touch it. I love to tear it. I love to fold it into books. I just love that paper. What else did I put on that list, Helen?
Golden open acrylic. So you
Of
mentioned you
course.
do jelly printing, so that's what you
Right.
use. And the
So,
open, there's so many different golden products, so open is the key word there.
open, and I also use fluids for marbling.
Okay.
Always the golden, though.
Right.
I've tried many other things. No.
And then you mentioned Galen Berry.
Yeah, do you know him?
I know of him. I've never met him.
Did you go to, do you travel to various, because I know your wonderful Sunday newsletter
Sunday
takes
paper.
us, Sunday paper takes us all around the world. Of course, Sunday paper. Why would I say newsletter? And there was a display in Grolier's, was it, where it was all the
Oh.
marbling, and he had pieces there on display.
I didn't make it to that. That was Mindy Dubansky's book about pattern and decoration, I think, and different surface designers were exhibited.
Yes, and historically too, it was gorgeous. But I like his paper, although his paper has just changed. The one paper that I've marbled with has gone out of stock, so trying a new paper now with him. But
So
that
does
paper
that
is the best to
mean
marble.
you? I don't know this word, municing
That's
paper?
their new paper that
That's
they're replacing the old paper with.
so Galen
I have.
Berry actually sells it. Is that what
Yes,
you're
he
saying?
does.
Okay.
He sells marbling tools, marbling paints, and
Yes.
this paper.
Okay, cool. Yeah, we'll put all these recommendations in the show notes. And then you like the Talk Easy podcast.
Well, I put that in there because you're such a great interviewer. And part of my research for My Life in Paper, when I was working on books, I went to, I don't even know how many of your podcasts. You must have seen these
Oh.
downloads like every day.
I'm not good at
You had so many interesting people on this show, and I just would listen to person after person. And then, so I thought that you might like to hear Sam Fragoso, who is a very young, do you know him?
No.
Oh my gosh. He's very young, and he's interviewing people like Cate Blanchett and Padma, you know, the great cook and food expert, and really interesting, Lord, you know, and
Oh.
The Haim sisters, but Sandra Cisneros, George Saunders, I could go
Oh.
on. And I listen to him when I'm taking a walk usually. And the thing about him is, and why it's relevant to artists, to writers, to you, is his capacity for incredibly deep and personal conversation that is not shameful or, you know, prying is out of this world. And to a guest, I mean, he had Joyce Carol Oates on, and you know, that was 2 years ago, but and she's very in the beginning of the podcast, you know, it's another interview kind of attitude. But at the end, she was like,
His
You know, you
best
had the
friend.
feeling that she was saying, this was amazing. Padma, when she was on, says, can we just keep talking? And Sam says to her, well, you have to go to the Jimmy Kimmel show now. And she said, yeah, but I want to stay on this podcast. He just does conversation in a way that I have never heard conversation.
I'm going to check it out. Thank you.
400 episodes to choose from, Helen.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Well, I listen in the studio. So it depends what I'm working on, whether I can listen also or not. But yeah, that's usually, or driving also. So yeah,
I
I've
bet
got
you're
time.
not listening. You're not listening when doing triaxial weaves. Right?
No, I could now. I could
Oh,
now.
wow.
At the
You are
beginning,
so
no
advanced.
way. Yeah. I'm telling you, it's like riding a bike. Triaxial weaving, listeners, it's really hard to get down. But once you get it, you kind of get it. You have to do a little refresher, maybe if you've taken a year off. But yeah. Okay, well, Beth, this has been so fun. Tell us where we can find your book, My Life in Paper, and where we can find you online.
So I have three websites. One is bind-arts.com. That's the work with my husband. BethKephartBooks.com is where my books and my essays live. And Juncture Workshops is where the memoir stuff. The book can be, it's in Philadelphia stores. It can be ordered anywhere. And today, the Boston Globe has an essay that I wrote that is captures the sort of emotional end of this book. So there are parts of this book, or, you know, essences of the book that are also on my BethKephartBooks.com site, where you can see some pieces that have been excerpted, that sort of, or some conversations I had, not like this, but over email with people about the book.
Oh, great. Yeah. And I'll link to the Boston Globe article in the show notes too, if it's available for people to grab. Okay. Well, this has been a real treat. Thank you for coming on the podcast and telling us about your life with paper.
Well, it was a great, great honor. Whenever anybody says, who knows the most about paper? It's so cool to have an easy answer, not have to go, like when people ask me who my favorite author is, I say, but when they say, who knows the most about paper, I'm like, Helen.
Well, thank
So
you.
it's a great pleasure and privilege to be with you.
Thanks, Beth.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can find out more at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.
There's a reason besides the season, the making paper.